Shassa felt a rush of deep affection for this wise and gentle old man. In some strange way, the fact that they had both suffered mutilation, Sir Garry's leg and Shassa's eye, seemed to have forged an even stronger bond between them. "It's years since I have been up to visit you and Anna at Thunis Kraal," Shassa burst out impulsively. "May I come to spend a couple of weeks with you?" "Nothing would give us greater pleasure." Sir Garry hugged him, and at that moment Field Marshal Smuts came across. "Still talking, old Garry? Do you never stop? Come along now. We have a mountain to climb, and the last one to the top gets sent to an old age home." The old friends smiled at each other. They could have been brothers, both slight of build but wiry and dapper, both with little silver goatee beards and disreputable old hats upon their heads. "Forward!" Sir Garry brandished his cane, linked his arm through the field marshal's, and led him to the back seat of Santaine's yellow Daimler. The Daimler led the procession, followed by Blaine's Bentley, and Tara blew Sasha a kiss as it passed. He stood on the front steps of Veltevreden, and it was very quiet after they had all gone. He turned back into the house and went upstairs to his own room, selected a batch of clean shirts, socks and underpants from his drawers, and stuffed them into a grip. On the way downstairs, he turned aside, went into Santaine's study, and picked up the telephone. One of the duty sergeants in the operations room at CID headquarters answered. "Hello, Sergeant. Have there been any messages for me?" "Hold on, sir, I'll have a look." He was back in a few seconds. "Only one, sir. 10 minutes ago. A woman. Wouldn't leave her name." "Thank you, Sergeant." Shassa hung up quickly. He found that his hand was trembling and his breath had shortened. A woman wouldn't leave her name. It had to be her. Why hadn't she called him here? She had the number. He stood over the phone, willing it to ring. Nothing happened. After 5 minutes, he began to pace the floor, moving restlessly between the white French windows and the huge ormolu Louis XIV's desk, watching the silent telephone. He was undecided. Should he go back to CID headquarters in case she called there again? But what if she came through here? Should he ring the sergeant? But that would block the line. "Come on," he pleaded. "Come on." He glanced at his wristwatch. 35 minutes he had wasted in indecision. "I'll have to pack it up. Can't stand here all day." He went to the desk. He reached for the instrument, but before he could touch it, it rang. He hadn't been ready for it. The sound raked his nerves shrilly, and he snatched it up. "Squadron Leader Courtney," he spoke in Afrikaans. "Is that you, Mevrou?" "I forgot the number. I had to go back to the house to fetch it," she said. Her voice was rough with exertion. She had been running. "I couldn't call before. There were people. My husband..." She broke off. She had said too much. "That is all right. Don't worry. Everything is all right," said Shassa. "No," she said. "It's terrible what they're going to do. It's just terrible."
"Do you want to tell me?"
"They are going to kill the field marshal."
"The field marshal?
The Ubas. Field Marshal Smuts." He could not speak for a moment, and then he rallied. "Do you know when they plan to do it?" "Today. They will shoot him today."
"That's not possible." He did not want to believe it. "The Ubas has gone up Table Mountain today. He is on a picnic with..."
"Yes, yes," the woman was sobbing, "on the mountain. White Sword is waiting for him on the mountain."
"Oh, my God," Shassa whispered. He felt as though he were paralyzed. His legs were filled with concrete, and a great weight crushed his lungs so that for a moment he could not breathe. "You are a brave woman," he said. "Thank you for what you have done." He dropped the telephone onto its cradle and snatched open the drawer of Santaine's desk. The gold-engraved Beretta pistols were in their presentation case. He lifted one of them out of its nest of green baize and checked the load. There were six in the magazine, and an extra magazine in a separate slot in the case. He thrust the pistol into his belt and the magazine into his pocket and turned for the door. The pistol was useless at anything farther than point-blank range, but the hunting rifles were locked in the cabinet in the gun room, the ammunition was kept separately, his key was in the jag. It would take precious minutes to fetch it, open the cabinet, unchain his 9.3 Mannlicher, find the ammunition. He could not afford the time. The picnic party had a start of nearly 40 minutes on him. They might be halfway up the mountain by now. All the people he loved were there, and an assassin was waiting for them. He sprinted down the steps and sprang into the open cockpit of the Jag. She started with a roar. He spun her in a tight circle, gravel spraying from under the back tyres, and went down the long drive with the needle climbing quickly to the 80 mph notch. He went out through the Anreath gates and into the narrow curves and dips as the road skirted the base of the mountain. More than once he nearly ran out of road as the Jag snarled and screeched through the gates of the Kirstenbach Botanical Gardens and at last pulled into the parking area behind the curator's office. The other vehicles were there, parked in a straggling line, the Daimler and the Bentley, and Denny Rietz's Packard, but the parking area was deserted. He took one quick look up at the mountain that towered 2,000 feet above him. He could make out the path as it climbed out of the forest and zigzagged up the gut of Skeleton Gorge, passing the pimple of Breakfast Rock on the skyline, and then crossing the rim onto the tableland. There was a line of moving specks on the pathway, just emerging from the forest. The Ubas and Grand Pater were setting their usual furious pace, proving to each other how fit they were, and as he shaded his eyes, he recognized Mater's yellow dress and Tara's turquoise skirt, just tiny flecks of colour against the grey and green wall of the mountain. They were trailing far behind the leaders. He began to run. He took the first easy slope at a trot, pacing himself. He reached the 300-metre contour path and paused beside the concrete signpost to draw a few long breaths. He surveyed the track ahead. It went up very steeply from here, jigging through the forest, following the bank of the stream, a series of uneven, rocky steps. He went at it fast, but his town shoes had thin leather soles and gave him little purchase. He was panting wildly, and his shirt was soaked through with sweat as he came out of the forest. Still almost 1,000 feet to the top, but he saw immediately that he had gained on the picnic party. They were strung out down the pathway. The two figures leading were Grand Pater and the Ubas. At this distance it was impossible to distinguish between them, but that was Blaine a few paces behind them. He would be hanging back so as not to force the elder men to a pace beyond their strength. The rest of the party were in groups and singles, taking up half the slope, with the women far in the rear. He drew a deep breath and shouted. The women paused and looked back down the slope. "Stop!" he yelled with all his lung power. "Stop!" One of the women waved. It was probably Matty. Then they began to climb again. They had not recognized him, nor had they understood the command to stop. They had taken him for just another friendly hiker. He was wasting time. The leaders were just under the crest of the summit. Shasta began to climb with all his strength, leaping over the uneven footing, forcing himself to ignore the burning of his lungs and the numbing exhaustion of his legs, driving himself upwards by sheer force of will. Tara looked back when he was only 10 feet below her. "Shasta," she cried, delighted but surprised, "what are you doing?" He brushed past her. "Can't stop," he grunted and went on up, passing Anna and then Mater. "What is it, Shasta?" "Later." There was no wind for words. His whole existence was in his agonized legs, and the sweat poured into his eye, blurring his vision. He saw the leaders make the last short traverse before going over the top, and he stopped and tried to shout again. It came out as an agonized wheeze, and as he watched Grand Pater and the Ubas disappear over the crest of the slope, with Blaine only 20 paces behind them. The shot was dulled by distance, But even so, Shasser recognized the sharp, distinctive crack of a Mauser. From somewhere, he found new strength, and he flew at the slope, leaping from rock to rock. The single shot seemed to echo and re-echo through his head, and he heard somebody shouting, or perhaps it was only the wild sobbing of his breath and the thunder of his blood in his own eardrums. Manfred de la Rey lay all that night in his hide. At sunrise he stood up and swung his arms, squatted and twisted to loosen his muscles and banish the chill that had soaked through the overcoat into his bones. He moved a few paces back and emptied his bladder. Then he stripped off the overcoat and the jersey. Both had been bought from a second-hand clothes dealer on the parade. They were unmarked and could never be traced to him. He bundled them and stuffed them under a rock. Then he settled back in his hide, stretched out on the tarpaulin. A few blades of grass were obscuring his line of fire, and he broke them off and aimed at the head of the path. His aim was clear and uninterrupted. He worked a cartridge from the magazine into the breech of the Mauser, checking it visually as it slid home, and he locked the bolt down. Once more he took his aim, and this time he curled his finger round the rear trigger and carefully set the hair trigger with that crisp, satisfying little click. Then he pushed the safety catch over with his thumb and laid the rifle on the tarpaulin in front of him. He froze into immobility. Patient as a leopard in a tree above a waterhole, only his yellow eyes alive, he let the hours drift by, never for an instant relaxing his vigil. When it happened with the abruptness that might have taken another watcher by surprise. There was no warning, no sound of footsteps or voices. The range was too long for that. Suddenly, a human figure appeared on the head of the path, silhouetted against the blue of the sky. Manfred was ready for it. He lifted the rifle to his shoulder with a single fluid movement, and his eye went naturally to the aperture of the lens. He did not have to pan the telescopic sight. The image of the man appeared instantly in his field of vision, enlarged and crisply focused. It was an old man with thin and narrow shoulders, wearing an open-neck white shirt and a Panama hat that was yellow with age. His silver goatee beard sparkled in the bright spring sunshine. The unwavering crosshairs of the telescope were already perfectly aligned on the exact centre of his narrow chest, a hand's breadth below the V of his open shirt. No fancy headshot, Manfred had decided. Take him through the heart. He touched the hair trigger, and the Mauser clapped in his eardrums, and the butt drove back into his shoulder. He saw the bullet strike. It flapped the loose white shirt against the skinny old chest, and Manfred's vision was so heightened that he even saw the bullet exit. It flew out of the old man's back on a long pink tail of blood and living tissue, like a flamingo's feather. And as the frail body was plucked out of sight into the grass, the cloud of blood persisted, hanging in the clear morning air for the thousandth part of a second before it settled. Manfred rolled to his feet and started to run. He had plotted every yard of his escape route back to the Morris, and a savage elation gave strength to his legs and speed to his feet. Behind him, somebody shouted, a plaintive, bewildered sound. But Manfred did not check or look back. Shasser came over the crest at a full run. The two men were kneeling beside the body that lay in the grass at the side of the track. They looked up at Shasser, both their faces stricken. Shasser took one look at the body as it lay face down. The bullet must have been a dum-dum to inflict such a massive exit wound. It had carved a hole through the chest cavity into which he could have thrust both his fists. There was no hope. He was dead. He hardened himself. There would be time for grief later. Now was the time for vengeance. "Did you see who did it?" he gasped. "Yes." Blaine jumped to his feet. "I got a glimpse of him." He cut back around Udakral Kop, he said, dressed in blue.
Shasta knew this side of the mountain intimately, every path and cliff, every gorge and gully, between Constantia Neck and the saddle. The killer had turned at the foot of the kop. He had a start of less than 2 minutes.
"The bridle path!" Shasta gasped. "He is heading for the bridle path. I'll try and cut him off at the top of Nursery Ravine."
He started to run again back towards Breakfast Rock.
"Shasta, be careful!" Blaine yelled at him. "He has the rifle with him. I saw it."
The bridle path was the only way a vehicle could reach the tableland, Shasta reasoned as he ran, and this had been so carefully planned that the killer must have an escape vehicle. It had to be parked somewhere on the bridle path. The footpath made a wide loop around Udakral Kop, then came back to the edge and ran along the cliff top past the head of Nursery Ravine, until it intersected the bridle path half a mile further on. There was another rough, little-used path that cut this side of the kop along the cliff top. The beginning was difficult to find, and a mistake would lead into a dead end against the precipice, but if he found it, he could cut a quarter of a mile off the route. He found the path and turned off into it. At two places, the track was overgrown, and he had to struggle through interlaced branches. At another spot, at the edge of the track, had washed away. He had to back up and take a run at it, jumping over the gap, with 500 feet of open drop below him. He landed on his knees, clawed himself to his feet, and kept running. He burst out unexpectedly into the main footpath, and collided at full tilt with the blue-overalled killer coming in the opposite direction. He had a fleeting impression of the man's size and the breadth of his shoulders, and then they were down together, locked chest to chest, grappling savagely, rolling down the slope of the path. The impact had knocked the rifle out of the killer's hand, but Shasta felt the springy hardness and the bulk of his muscle, and the first evidence of the man's strength shocked him. He knew instantly that he was outmatched. Against his fiercest resistance, the man rolled him under his back and came up on top of him, straddling him. Their faces were inches apart. The man had a thick, dark, curling beard that was sodden with sweat. His nose was twisted, and his brows were dense and black, but it was the eyes that struck terror into Shasta. They were yellow and somehow dreadfully familiar. However, they galvanized Shasta, transforming his terror into superhuman strength. He wrenched one arm free and rolled the killer over far enough to yank the Beretta pistol from his own belt. He had not loaded a cartridge into the chamber, but he struck upwards with a short barrel, smashing it into the man's temple, and he heard the steel crack on the bone of the skull. The man's grip slackened and he fell back. Shasta wriggled to his knees, fumbling to load the Beretta. With a metallic snicker, the slide pushed a cartridge into the chamber, and he lifted the barrel. He had not realized how close they had rolled to the clifftop. He was kneeling on the very brink, and as he tried to steady his aim on that bearded head, the killer jackknifed his body and drove both feet into Shasta's chest. Shasta was hurled backwards. The pistol fired, but the shot went straight into the air, and he found himself falling free as he went over the edge of the cliff. He had a glimpse down the precipice. There was an open drop for hundreds of feet. But he fell less than 10 of those before he wedged behind a pine sapling that had found a foothold in a cleft of the rock. He hung against the cliff face, his legs dangling free, winded and dazed, and he looked up. The killer's head appeared over the edge of the cliff. Those strange yellow eyes glared at him for an instant and then disappeared. Shasta heard his boots scrabble on the pathway, and then the unmistakable sound of a rifle bolt being loaded and cocked. "He is going to finish me off," he thought, and only then realized that he still had the Beretta in his right hand. Desperately, he hooked his left elbow over the pine sapling and pointed the Beretta up at the rim of the cliff above his head. Once more, the killer's head and shoulders appeared against the sky, and he was swinging the long barrel of the Mauser downwards.
But the weapon was awkward to point at this angle, and Shassa fired an instant before it could bear. He heard the light bullet of the pistol strike against flesh, and the killer grunted and disappeared from view. A moment afterwards he heard someone else shout from a distance and recognized Blaine's voice. Then the killer's running footsteps moved swiftly away as he set off along the path once more, and a minute later Blaine looked down at Shassa from the clifftop. "Hold on!" Blaine's face was flushed with exertion and his voice unsteady. He pulled the thick leather belt from his trouser top and buckled it into a loop. Lying flat on his belly at the top of the cliff, he lowered the looped belt and Shassa hooked his arm through it. Even though Blaine was a powerful man with abnormal arm and chest development from polo practice, they struggled for minutes before he could drag Shassa over the top of the cliff. They lay together for a few moments, and then Shassa pulled himself unsteadily to his feet and staggered off along the pathway in pursuit of the fugitive. Within a dozen paces, Blaine pulled ahead of him, running strongly, and his example spurred Shassa. He kept up, and Blaine gasped over his shoulder. "Blood!" He pointed to the wet red speckles on a flat stone in the pathway. "You hit him!" They came out onto the wide bridle path and started down, running shoulder to shoulder now, helped by the gradient of the descent. But they had not reached the first hairpin bend when they heard an engine start in the forest below. "He's got a car," Blaine panted as the engine whined into a crescendo. Then the sound of it receded swiftly. They pulled up and listened to it dwindle into silence. Shassa's legs could hold him up no longer. He sank into a heap in the middle of the road. There was a telephone at the Cecilia Forestry station, and Shassa got through to Inspector Nell at CID headquarters and gave him a description of the killer. "You'll have to move fast. The man has obviously got his escape planned." The mountain club kept a lightweight stretcher at the forestry station, for this mountain took many human lives each year. The forester gave them 6 of his black labourers to carry it and accompanied them back up the bridle path and along the mountain rim to the head of Skeleton Gorge. The women were there. Santaine and Anna were in tears, clinging to each other for comfort. They had spread one of the rugs over the dead man. Shassa knelt beside the body and lifted the corner of the rug. In death, Sir Gary Courtenay's features had fallen in, so that his nose was arched and beaky, his closed eyelids were in deep cavities, but there was about him a gentle dignity, so that he resembled the death mask of a fragile Caesar. Shassa kissed his forehead, and the skin was cool and velvety smooth against his lips. When he stood up, Field Marshal Smuts laid a hand of comfort on his shoulder. "I'm sorry, my boy," the old Field Marshal said. "That bullet was meant for me." Manfred de la Rey pulled off the road, steering with one hand. He did not leave the driver's seat of the Morris, and he kept the engine running while he unbuttoned the front of his overalls. The bullet had entered just below and in front of his armpit, punching into the thick pad of the pectoral muscle, and it had angled upwards. He could find no exit wound, the bullet was still lodged in his body, and when he groped gently around the back of his own shoulder, he found a swelling that was so tender that he almost screamed involuntarily as he touched it. The bullet was lying just under the skin, but it did not appear to have penetrated the chest cavity. He wadded his handkerchief over the wound in his armpit and buttoned the overalls. He checked his watch. It was a few minutes before 11 o'clock, just 23 minutes since he had fired the shot that would set his people free. A sense of passionate soaring triumph overrode the pain of his wound. He pulled back onto the road and drove sedately around the base of the mountain, down the main road through Woodstock. At the gates of the railway yards, he showed his pass to the gatekeeper and went through to park the Morris outside the restrooms for off-duty firemen and engine drivers. He left the Mauser under the seat of the Morris. Both the weapon and the vehicle would be taken care of. He crossed quickly to the back door of the restroom, and they were waiting for him inside. Rolf leapt to his feet anxiously as he saw the blood on the blue overalls. "Are you all right? What has happened?" "Smuts is dead," Manfred said, and his savage joy was transmitted to them. They did not cheer or speak, but stood quietly, savouring the moment on which history would hinge. Rolf broke the silence after a few seconds. "You are hurt." While one of the Sturmjägers went out and drove the Morris away, Rolf helped Manfred strip off his soiled overalls. There was very little blood now, but the flesh around the wound was swollen and bruised. The bullet hole itself was a black puncture that wept watery pink lymph. Rolf dressed and bound it up with bandages from a railway first aid kit. Because Manfred had very little use of his left arm, Rolf lathered the black beard and shaved it off with a straight razor for him. With the beard gone, Manfred was years younger, handsome and clean-cut once again, but pale from loss of blood and the weakness of his wound. They helped him into a clean pair of overalls, and Rolf set the fireman's cap on his head. "We will meet again soon," Rolf told him, "and I am proud to be your friend. From now on, glory will follow you all the days of your life." The engine driver came forward. "We must go," he said. Rolf and Manfred shook hands, and then Manfred turned away and followed the driver out of the restroom and down the platform to the waiting locomotive. The police stopped the northbound goods train at Worcester Station. They opened and searched all the trucks, and a constable climbed into the cab of the locomotive and searched that also. "What is the trouble?" the engine driver demanded. "There has been a murder," said the policeman. "Some bigwig was shot on Table Mountain this morning. We've got a description of the killer. There are police roadblocks on all the roads, and we are searching every motor vehicle and ship and train." "Who was killed?" Manfred asked. And the constable shrugged. "I don't know, my friend, but judging by the fuss, it's somebody important." He climbed down from the cab, and a few minutes later the signals changed to green, and they rolled out of the station, heading north. By the time they reached Bloemfontein, Manfred's shoulder had swollen into a hard purple hump, and the pain was insupportable. He sat hunched in a corner of the cab, moaning softly, teetering on the brink of consciousness, the rustle of dark wings filling his head. Rolf had telephoned ahead, and there were friends to meet him and smuggle him out of the Bloemfontein railway yards.
"Where are we going?"
"A doctor," they told him, and reality broke up into a patchwork of darkness and pain. He was aware of the choking reek of chloroform, and when he woke, he was in a bed in a sunny but monastically furnished room. The shoulder was bound up in crisp white bandages, and despite the lingering nausea of the anaesthetic, he felt whole again. There was a man sitting in the chair beside the window, and as soon as he realized Manfred was awake, he came to him.
"How do you feel?"
"Not too bad. Has it happened, the rising? Have our people seized power?" The man looked at him strangely.
"You do not know?" he asked.
"I only know that we have succeeded," Manfred began. But the man fetched a newspaper and laid it on the bed. He stood beside Manfred as he read the headlines. "Assassination on Table Mountain. OB blamed for killing of prominent historian. Smuts orders arrest and internment of 600.